Democratic board members prioritizing trendy social justice issues, all of it aimed at the November elections. They keep saying a strong return to school, but there is no details, said Sandra Davis on Fox News over the summer, co-founder of one large group called the Open Fairfax Public Schools Coalition. Their attention is on their things, like their pet projects and social justice issues, and the kids have been left to flounder, and there is still no plan for fall. You will be surprised to know I am a Democrat, she said. I have tried to warn them that there is a bipartisan tidal wave coming their way. They don't look us in the eye. They don't write us back. If we can recall them one by one, there is an election in November. That fall, Davis cut an ad for Youngkin, citing his commitment to keep schools open as decisive. And while the group made a Democrat angry at Democrats, the face of its opposition behind her was a coterie of Republican operatives. The bulk of the group's financing came from End to America, a conservative nonprofit, and Republican gubernatorial candidate Pete Snyder. Its co-founder was a Republican who lost a 2019 race for school board, and the rest of its officers were Republican operatives too. A slick nonprofit named Parents Defending Education was launched in 2020 to help guide the local groups. Little effort was made to conceal who was behind it. A longtime coach network operative, Nicole Neely, was placed at the helm of the grassroots organization. Aside from Davis, nearly every mom and dad brought onto Fox News to complain about critical race theory held a day job as a senior Republican operative. It was the purest expression of the way Republicans have driven the fight over schools and then capitalized on it. The fear of public schools indoctrinating our children has been a GOP theme for its base voters for decades. But in the wake of Trump's rise, the party watched in horror as suburban voters recoiled from Republicans into the arms of Democrats. Casting about for an issue that could win some of them back, recall that this is a game of margins, not absolutes, the party landed on the schools. Around the U.S., the conservative media apparatus, unrivaled by Democrats, gave air cover to the schooling issue, handing local activists language to use, a story to tell, and the resources and platform to tell it. The tactic was even more potent in Northern Virginia, where many professional Republican operatives and lobbyists live. In Loudoun County this November, McAfee outpaced Youngkin 55% to 44%, but Biden had beaten Trump there by 62% to 37%. Youngkin's showing was only 11,000 votes fewer than Trump 1 year earlier, while McAfee notched 50,000 fewer votes than Biden had. While Biden carried Fairfax by 42 points, McAfee only took it by 31. That the GOP didn't make even bigger inroads given their heavy investment in the issue, maybe the one silver lining for Democrats who witnessing a dishonest AstroTurf campaign take shape and get twisted beyond all recognition on Fox News, decided perhaps, understandably, but to their later regret, to ignore the question. After McAfee's debate gaffe, in which he delivered up the perfect sound bite to Youngkin, I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach. It took weeks to respond, initially not recognizing the danger. Everybody clapped when I said, McAfee insisted later. Even where Republicans spent heavily against outmatched Democrats, they made only marginal gains in school board races. But if the issue continues to go uncontested, their luck may run out. National Democrats have no coordinated response yet, leaving school board members unstaffed, underfunded, borderline volunteers hung out to dry, with nothing to rely on but mainstream media assertions that there is actually nothing to see here. Communique.
The United States is appealing a British judge's decision not to extradite Julian Assange, the Australian journalist and founder of WikiLeaks. In January, Judge Baretzer found that U.S. prison conditions would be too oppressive and that Assange would be likely to take his own life. In response, the United States has taken to the High Court to contest her findings about Assange's health. In addition, the United States has offered up diplomatic assurances, saying that it won't put Assange in oppressive prison conditions, which doctors have said would lead to suicide. So what exactly are these diplomatic assurances that the United States has offered? And can they actually be trusted? How come Assange's health is the center of the discussion when scores of legal experts, academics, journalists, and historians have all warned that this indictment currently poses the biggest threat to press freedoms? To answer these questions, I attended the court proceedings remotely as they unfolded in London's High Court. And this is what I saw. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The High Court appeal took place on October 27 and 28 of 2021, lasting just 2 days. The United States is appealing Judge Baretzer's decision not to extradite Julian Assange on five grounds. These five grounds can be summed up in two topics. Number one, Assange's health, and number two, the diplomatic assurances. We'll deal first with Assange's health. As we've mentioned before, Judge Baretzer blocked Assange's extradition to the U.S., namely on health grounds. So what has the United States responded? Well, the U.S. lawyers argue that she erred in her judgment, that she didn't apply the test correctly, that Assange doesn't meet the criteria for his extradition to be oppressive. They accuse him of essentially being a malingerer, someone who's pretending to be sick. Professor Michael Kupperman is the lead medical expert for the defense. Kupperman's testimony is very important because the judge relied heavily on it to block the extradition. She said that she preferred his testimony because his notes were more detailed than the other doctors. Kupperman also spent the most time with Assange. So because Kupperman's testimony is so crucial for the defense, the United States lawyers have tried desperately to discredit both the report and Kupperman. In his first psychiatric report, Kupperman did not disclose the relationship between Julian Assange and Stella Morris, or that they had had two children in the Ecuadorian embassy. Although this point has nothing to do with medicine or psychiatry, the United States is exploiting it to accuse Kupperman of misleading the court. They say that his medical evidence should be given little or no weight. Now, Assange's lawyers replied that Kupperman did not conceal anything from the court. He only kept the relationship secret because he was concerned for the privacy and safety of Ms. Morris and her children. This happened right around the time when we were finding out about Assange being spied on in the Ecuadorian embassy, among other things. In her ruling, Judge Baretzer did say that she found this behavior from Kupperman misleading and inappropriate, but an understandable human response to Ms. Morris' predicament. The lead prosecutor for the United States, James Lewis, accuses Assange of being a malingerer trying to avoid extradition. In the High Court, Lewis said that, quote, if he's clever enough, he can get around extradition. It then becomes a trump card which cannot be dealt with by the requesting state, no matter if the prevention matters are 100 times better than in England. The prosecution argued that Assange did not meet the criteria under the Turner test, meaning he must be unable to resist the impulse to commit suicide. Only that could block extradition. Now, Assange's lawyers respond that Professor Kupperman did find this to be the case. Kupperman said that Assange cannot resist the impulse to commit suicide. If he's extradited, he will take his own life. Assange's lawyers also pointed out that there are people who make plans to take their own lives. That's not impulsive, but it's still driven by their mental disorder. And so it's unreasonable, it doesn't make sense, to say that Assange is not suicidal just because he's not impulsively suicidal. Now, the entire appeal hearing at the High Court is, of course, too large to condense into one episode, but nevertheless, it consisted of various accusations from the prosecution that the defense's medical experts were lacking in expertise or integrity. For example, that Koppelman had misled the court, that Dr. Dealey was wrong in his autism diagnosis, and so forth. Now, the other main topic discussed in the High Court was that of diplomatic assurances. The United States has said that if Assange is extradited, it will not place him in special administrative measures, or SAMs, which are some of the worst prison conditions imaginable. The US also says that Assange won't be sent to ADX Florence, one of the worst prisons in the country. Robert Hood, the former warden at ADX Florence, described it as worse than death. The US also claims that Assange could serve a potential sentence in his home country of Australia. In the High Court, I actually saw Lewis say that Assange can't be that suicidal because he can look forward to going to jail in Australia, as if going to jail in one's home country is something that every journalist dreams of. Now, the prosecution claimed that they weren't given a fair chance to offer these assurances before, and had they, the judge would have decided differently. Well, Assange's lawyers point out that this isn't true. They say the United States had many opportunities to offer assurances that Assange won't be placed under SAMs. Instead, the prosecution not only said that SAMs are possible, but that they're okay. They said that Assange can play crochet and write poetry and self-recreate, which essentially means going into an adjacent empty room to spend time by himself. Now, Maureen Baird used to be the warden of a notorious jail in New York, Metropolitan Correctional Center, MCC. She testified at Assange's hearing and described what prison conditions are like in pretrial SAMs. She said that inmates were in solitary confinement, technically for 24 hours a day. There was absolutely no communication by any means with other inmates, and the only form of human interaction they had was when the guards came to inspect their cells or give them food through the slot in the door. Last year, when I was in court at the Old Bailey, I heard anonymous testimony from former employees of UC Global. UC Global is the Spanish firm in charge of security at the Ecuadorian embassy where Assange had been given political asylum. Now, the employees described how the United States got them to spy on Assange by installing cameras and secret microphones, and there were even discussions about physically hurting or kidnapping the WikiLeaks founder. And last week, for the first time, we saw the Yahoo News story brought up in court. Published in September, it has 30 US officials admitting that the CIA was discussing plans to potentially assassinate Assange or kidnap him in London. This corroborated what we already knew from UC Global. Assange's lawyers pointed out that even former CIA Director Mike Pompeo confirmed this to be true. So if the decision to place Assange under SAMs is up to the Attorney General with kind input from the CIA, of course they're going to put him in SAMs. This is the same agency that was discussing maybe killing Assange. It's the same agency whose files he published in 2017 in the Vault 7 leaks. There is no doubt that they will put him in SAMs. Now, Assange's lawyers explained that even if Assange isn't placed in SAMs, which is certain he will be, he can still be put in other oppressive conditions. Mark Summers, Assange's lawyer, said, "You can proceed entirely confident that in the event of surrender to the USA, Julian Assange will enter into administrative segregation, ADSEG, at Alexandria for years." He added that ADSEG is isolation. There is no assurance from the US not to place Assange under ADSEG. All the evidence, including Kronberg's, is that ADSEG is in prospect for Mr. Assange. Assange's lawyer, Mark Summers, added that even if ADX Colorado is off the table, Assange would be sent to a communications management unit, or CMU. It's a prison within a prison, an experiment in social isolation. Correspondence is limited to 1 6-page letter a week to one recipient. And in regards to being sent to Australia, Assange's lawyer argued that, first of all, Australia hasn't even accepted or said yes. And even if it did say yes, who says that future politicians would agree? We have no idea who will be in power in 10 years when this process is actually finished. This is a process that could take a very long time, and Assange would most certainly be in isolation for the entire duration. That isolation would lead him to take his own life, as doctors confirmed to the court. Now, the United States lawyers said that these assurances are solemn undertakings given out at the highest order. These are not dished out like Smarties. Lewis added that the United States has never broken a diplomatic assurance ever. Now, Assange's lawyers don't believe that to be true. They say these assurances can't be trusted because they are worded in a way that binds the prosecutors but not the Department of Justice. So even if Assange is extradited and placed in SAMS and he complains, the Department of Justice can just say, we never promised you that. Assange's lawyers gave examples of other people who were given false assurances by the US. They were extradited thinking they'd be placed in a medical unit or hospitalized and then sent instead to ADX. The United States even has a disclaimer in the assurance where it practically admits that Assange will be placed under SAMS. It says very clearly, Mr. Assange will not be subject to SAMS or imprisonment at ADX unless he does something that would warrant to them, like threatening national security. This means they certainly will place him under SAMS because the whole case is built on the false premise that Assange and WikiLeaks endangered national security. Assange's lawyer, Mark Summers, added that even in the event of acquittal in the United States, what Gordon Cromberg could do is summon him before a grand jury, incarcerate him for civil contempt, and place him in a special housing unit. So even if Assange is acquitted, he could still go back to jail. And it's not just a possibility, it's actually a likelihood, because Cromberg did precisely this to Chelsea Manning when she refused to testify against Julian Assange. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now joining me is Kevin Gostola, an American journalist whose work focuses on whistleblower and national security cases. Besides the Assange court hearings, he's also covered the cases of Chelsea Manning, John Kiriakou, Daniel Hale, and others. Kevin is also the managing director of Shadowproof, as well as producer and co-host of the weekly podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure. So Kevin, given the United States history, what they've done to other prisoners who were also given so-called assurances, not diplomatic ones, but nevertheless, they were misled, weren't they? I mean, if we look at what they did to Daniel Hale just a few months ago, or Chelsea Manning, which you both covered, do you lend these diplomatic assurances any credence above others?
All four of these assurances have significant loopholes. I'll start with the more generic thing that we should really look at, which is the UK government is supposedly the government that would represent Julian Assange's interests if he did not think the U.S. government upheld the assurances that are given by the U.S. government. So in other words, what we see in the United States' argument to the High Court of Justice that we should trust the U.S. government's assurances is that he would have the ability to file some kind of a challenge if he didn't believe that they were being upheld. And he would first go to the UK government and they would tell the US government that Julian Assange says he isn't getting the medical care he needs, or he believes it's wrong that he's been put in special administrative measures, or that he's in these restrictive solitary conditions in Alexandria Detention Center while waiting to be put on trial. And that is ridiculous because the UK government, I can't imagine wanting to be any sort of ally of Julian Assange given what they've done. Well, first off, this isn't really even about the case, but we know from Italian journalist Stefania Merizzi that the UK government has actively fought Freedom of Information Act requests for basic details about what these services in the country, like the Crown Prosecution Service, I think she might have even asked for records from the police department, what they were doing in order to target people who are associates of WikiLeaks, like Kristen Harrafson, who's now the editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks, Joseph Farrell, Sarah Harrison, who, by the way, is an unindicted co-conspirator in the latest indictment in this case, something that is concerning. And so she's asked for these records, and they won't give them to her. And then also... We know that there are records that have been destroyed historically related to the Assange extradition, going back to the Swedish case. But in the last decade, we know that there are records that no longer exist because the government actually destroyed those records. And this is the government we're supposed to believe will advocate for Assange to the U.S. government, that he should not be mistreated and that his human rights should be upheld. It's laughable.
You know, we heard things in court about how Assange could communicate with prisoners above and below through the plumbing. You know, Kronberg insists that ADSEG is not isolation. I mean, what do you think of not just ADSEG, but also the other kinds of hellholes they could put Assange in, right? Because his lawyers pointed out there's a possibility of being sent to a CMU or an SHU. I mean, are these, you know, prisons that different from ADX? You know, having covered Chelsea Manning and Daniel Hale's trials, you know all too well that they have a way of putting these people through enormous suffering, don't they?
Yeah. So let's take Chelsea Manning. She went through untold amounts of suffering for a year in a jail, refusing to cooperate with this grand jury. And toward the end, she attempted suicide yet again, another time. She had attempted suicide when she was at Fort Leavenworth serving her sentence, her military prison sentence. So again, this put her in a position where she was near a psychotic break, and she attempted suicide, and she did that because of the conditions of her jailing, her detention, while she was resisting a grand jury subpoena. She didn't know when she was going to be released. She ended up being released a few days after attempting suicide. This happened to her. If it happened to her, it could happen to Julian Assange while he's awaiting trial. This is the same jail that Daniel Hale was sent to while awaiting sentencing. They put him in there because they wanted to make everyone believe that his post-traumatic stress that he has from the moral injury of being involved in the drone program was something that was driving him crazy, and he was going to do self-harm to himself. His therapist actually ratted him out to pretrial services, and he ended up being thrown in jail and not able to prepare himself for going to prison. You know, do things like find a home for his cat, take care of any bills that he had, outstanding payments, put all of his things in order so that he could then go to prison. Something that a lot of people get to do when they know that they're going to be going off to prison. And they deprived him of his ability to do that. He was just picked up, taken to a jail, and he hasn't been free since. And now he's in a CMU, a communications management unit, and there he is in conditions that, in terms of social visits, it's actually worse than special administrative measures. It's been described as worse by the Center for Constitutional Rights because you do not have contact visits with any individuals who come to see you. So immediate family come, Stella, her children, his children come, Gabriel and Max, and he's on the other side of a partition. There's glass. He speaks, you know, I think he grabs the telephone, think of like the movies where they talk through the glass. He never gets to touch. He never gets to hug. He doesn't get to kiss his kids. They don't get to sit on his lap. He doesn't get to share any moments with them while he is in this facility if he gets sentenced to a CMU.
So besides an SHU or a CMU, I mean, what else could they do? Because ADSEG is pretty much guaranteed. If you ask me, SAMs are also pretty much guaranteed. Do you also feel that way, that these things are you know, practically set in stone for Assange?
Well, the other thing we should be concerned about, and Kronberg lays it out very clearly, is that Assange could be put in protective custody because he's a high-profile prisoner. And what that means is they get to do all sorts of things that they did to Chelsea Manning when she was first detained and was awaiting trial. You remember the international scandal that was sparked by her treatment at the Quantico Marine Brig, which has since been shut down. It actually does not exist. There are not people detained there anymore. And in that facility, I remember they took her clothing away, they took her underwear away, they took they made her wear the suicide smock which I saw displayed during the court-martial. I saw her put it on and demonstrate what it was like. It's this, like, itchy, uncomfortable thing that, like, nobody would be comfortable sleeping in, and especially in a prison. And they did this to her by twisting her words against her and reading into it the worst intentions. It was sarcasm, or she was talking about, you know, like, if you're going to do this to me, I could take the elastic in my waistband and I could do this with it. And then, just, I guess, to be a smart aleck, the military person who was overseeing her treatment decided, well, we need to take this seriously and take all of the clothing away. And when they called roll in the morning, she came out of her cell and she's completely naked, and everyone else has on what they're wearing in the prison. And everyone, you know, the people who are doing security for that prisoner, sort of like, why does this inmate not have any clothing on? She was treated like that as part of protective custody, the idea that they had to make sure no matter what, she survived and made it to her trial. Don't think they won't do the same thing to Julian Assange. They will say that they are putting him in restrictive conditions to protect his own safety in order to prevent him from doing anything to himself. They will take his mental health. They will use all of the worst claims that the defense has made to try and save him, and they will turn them against Julian Assange so that he is even more miserable, if you can believe it. I mean, you may not think, how could you be more miserable? They will find a lower low that they can take this while he is in confinement.
So, Kevin, a lot of people ask you and me when we're covering this case, when we'll get a decision from the judges, where we think this is going. When you or I were talking last time, you pulled out this very big chart with all the possibilities of where Assange's judicial process could go. Could you maybe walk us through all these various outcomes?
Yes. So if you look down at the left part of the screen toward the middle, you'll see that it says the U.S. appeals to the High Court. That's where we are. We're also, I think there's another box that has U.S. appeals to the High Court. But that's not the same route. Anyways, if you go down to the bottom here, now where you're circling, there are three actions that can happen. The court can dismiss it. Well, then what's going to happen is the U.S. will appeal and it'll go before the Supreme Court. If it accepts these assurances, these diplomatic assurances that we do not find to be of any value, then it'll potentially go back down to the district court level. And so you basically go back to go. And you have a hearing before, I hope it would be a different judge and not Vanessa Beretzer, but I suppose things have been kind of bizarre already, so maybe she gets to have another crack at it. But again, I would think that it would be a different judge. It should be. And they would have a hearing on these assurances and discuss why the legal team for Assange would have a hearing much like the extradition hearing in September 2020. And they would say, look, you know, we're sorry we have to do this. We don't like being here. The U.S. should have put these forward a long time ago, but now they have. And we're here to put evidence and bring forward witnesses and say that we do not believe that these assurances should be taken seriously. And then the judge would review them and decide, based on those assurances, whether to reject the extradition request or not. And then the appeals continue, and we go back to the High Court for another hearing, and then we go back to the UK Supreme Court for another hearing. And then that's the last stage.
Kevin Gostola, thank you so much for your time and your brilliant reporting. Keep up the good work. It's a pleasure speaking with you. No date has been set by the judges on when they will hand down a decision, but they did say they were given a lot to think about. And I agree, there is a lot to think about. Namely, why is this entire hearing focusing on Assange's health? You know, we can now see very clearly why January's decision was a positive but an inadequate one. While the judge blocked the extradition, which is good, she only did it on health grounds. Meanwhile, the political charges, she agreed with them all. So right now the whole discussion has shifted to Assange's health. You know, WikiLeaks published evidence of war crimes carried out by U.S. forces, intelligence agencies, and their allies. But instead of holding those politicians and soldiers accountable, the British justice system, at the behest of the United States, is putting Julian Assange on trial. And not just that, but his mental health on trial as well, reinforcing negative stigmas and stereotypes about mental illness. And when we talk about assurances, it's very important to point out the U.S.'s broken promises it made to other prisoners many times before. They purposely word these things in a way that binds the prosecutors, but not the Department of Justice, which means they're useless because the Department of Justice is the only one who has the power to grant these assurances in the first place. Let's be clear on something. Even if Assange were in perfect health, he should not be extradited because it is the wrong thing to do. Even if the United States says it will place him in a five-star hotel, it's still not okay to extradite him for doing his job. What is happening here is unprecedented. This is a vendetta. It's a witch hunt against Assange because his journalism threatens the most powerful armies and governments on Earth. A journalist should not have to prove that they are sick and suicidal beyond hope just to avoid extradition to a foreign country they have no connection to. If Julian Assange is suicidal in the first place, it is because they have made him this way by persecuting him. He has been persecuted by the same government that now claims it will treat him well. I'm sorry, but if you think the United States is not going to lock up Julian Assange in some dark hellhole the moment he sets foot on U.S. soil, then you're really kidding yourself. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Documents provided exclusively to the Grey Zone website detail Canberra's abandonment of Julian Assange, an Australian citizen, and provide shocking details of his prison suffering. Stay with us for the concluding part of a two-part article written by Kit Clarenberg, an investigative journalist exploring the role of intelligence services in shaping politics and perceptions. The piece is titled, New Files Expose Australian Government's Betrayal of Julian Assange, and detail his prison torment. On 30th of May that year, WikiLeaks made the shock announcement that Julian Assange had been moved to Belmarsh's medical ward, expressing grave concerns about the state of his health. Almost immediately, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade Global Watch Office fired off an internal email, drawing attention to the post. The following day, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman or Degrading Treatment, Niels Meltzer, proclaimed, "The collective persecution of Julian Assange must end here and now." The international legal veteran added that, "In 20 years of work with victims of war, violence and political persecution, he had never seen a group of democratic states ganging up to deliberately isolate, demonize and abuse a single individual for such a long length of time, and with so little regard for human dignity and the rule of law." Next, Niels Meltzer fulminated against a relentless and unrestrained campaign of public mobbing, intimidation and defamation by the United States, Britain, Sweden and Ecuador, which has subjected him to persistent, progressively severe abuse ranging from systematic judicial persecution and arbitrary confinement in the Ecuadorian embassy to his oppressive isolation, harassment and surveillance inside the embassy. response, Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade issued a statement rejecting any suggestion Canberra was complicit in psychological torture or has shown a lack of consular support in Julian Assange's regard, claiming to be a staunch defender of human rights and strong advocate for humane treatment in the course of judicial processes, and expressing confidence that he was being treated appropriately. Due to privacy considerations allegedly extended to all consular clients, the department declined to divulge any further details relating to his physical or mental state. It added that the Australian High Commission in London previously raised any health concerns identified with Belmarsh prison authorities, and these have been addressed with further inquiries made following Julian Assange's move to the health ward. The documents provided to the Grey Zone website indicate that Canberra did indeed make repeated inquiries to Belmarsh prison by phone and mail in the wake of WikiLeaks announcement, all of which went unanswered for 6 straight days. So why did Australia's High Commissioner not intervene and demand immediate clarity on the issue of literal life and death urgency? Whatever reason for the Australian government's foot dragging, a consular file dated 8th of August that year records how Shipton wrote to advise that Julian Assange had been readmitted to Belmarsh's sick bay, and a lawyer was drafting a letter to Australian Foreign Minister Maurice Payne requesting the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade use its diplomatic sources to seek an independent medical assessment, that is, outside of the prison. Then, just 11 days later, Shipton mentioned that Julian Assange's brother, Gabriel, had recently visited the prison and was distressed by Assange's deteriorating condition, leading him to write letters to both Australian Governor-General David Hurley and Scott Morrison, raising his fears. On 21st of October, Julian Assange appeared in court for a pre-trial hearing in his extradition case. As was widely reported in the mainstream media, he appeared frail and discombobulated, struggling to recall his own name and date of birth when asked by the judge. When the presiding judge inquired whether he even knew what was happening, Assange responded, "Not exactly," indicating conditions in Belmarsh prison left him unable to think properly. Assange's attorney, Mark Summers, argued that his initial extradition hearing scheduled for February of 2020 should be delayed by 3 months due to the complexity of the case. The evidence would test the limits of most lawyers, he said, and discussed the immense difficulty of communicating with his client in the jail, given he lacked access to a computer. The judge denied the request. As a result, Julian Assange would be deprived of the most basic of access to the bare minimum needs for proper representation until just weeks prior to the hearing. Three days later, Julian Assange's attorney, Gareth Pearce, wrote to the Australian High Commission asserting that if consular representative had attended court, they will have undoubtedly noted that was what was clear for everyone present in the courtroom to observe, that his client was in shockingly poor condition, struggling not only to cope, but to articulate what he wishes to articulate. Unbelievably, a Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade report on the proceedings unearthed by Kelly Tranter made no mention whatsoever of Julian Assange's dishevelled appearance or his clearly frayed mental state. Gareth Pearce went on to argue that under the circumstances, it was unsurprising that Julian Assange had not authorised prison officials to provide the Australian government with information regarding his medical treatment, which had been grossly and unlawfully compromised over some time, including, disturbingly, even while he had been in Belmarsh prison. False information on at least one occasion having been provided to the press by very obviously internal sources. She wrote, "We hope what we are able to say will be accepted by you as having been based on close observation, including by independent professional clinicians. Every professional warning provided to the prison, including by at least one independent doctor called in by Belmarsh, has been ignored," adding, "We should be pleased to meet with you at any stage if by intervention in what is now an impending crisis, you can contribute to its amelioration and avoidance." And so it was that consular officials visited Belmarsh on 1st of November. In their exchange, Julian Assange criticized false statements made to the media by the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade of Australia, which suggested he had rejected offers of their support. Next, he revealed that a prison doctor was concerned about his condition. In fact, Assange said his psychological state was so bad that his mind was shutting down. Almost permanent isolation made it impossible for him to think or to prepare for his defense. He did not even have a pen with which to write, was unable to do any research, could not receive documents during legal visits, and all his mail was read by prison officials before it was given to him. The next month, Professor Michael Koppelman, Emeritus Professor of Neuropsychiatry at King's College London, prepared a report on Julian Assange's psychiatric state based on meetings throughout his first 6 months in Belmarsh Prison, conversations with his parents, friends and colleagues, and Stella Morris, his wife and mother of his two children. As was revealed in Judge Vanessa Baratza's January ruling on the U.S. extradition request, Professor Koppelman diagnosed Julian Assange with a severe recurrent depressive disorder, which was occasionally accompanied by psychotic features such as hallucinations and frequent suicidal thoughts. His symptoms furthermore included loss of sleep and weight, impaired concentration, a persistent feeling of being on the verge of tears, and state of acute agitation in which he paced his cell until exhausted, punching his head or banging it against the wall. Julian Assange commented to Professor Koppelman that he believed his life was not worth living. He thought about suicide hundreds of times a day and had a constant desire to self-harm or commit suicide, describing plans to kill himself that the professor considered highly plausible. Calls to the Samaritans, a UK charity helpline providing emotional support to those in emotional distress, struggling to cope or at risk of suicide, were virtually a nightly occurrence. Professor Koppelman concluded that if Julian Assange was held in solitary confinement in the United States for a prolonged period, his mental health would deteriorate substantially, resulting in persistently severe clinical depression and a severe exacerbation of his anxiety disorder, PTSD, and suicidal ideas, not least because various protective factors available to him in Britain would be absent in the United States. Judge Breitzer recorded, "For example, he speaks to his wife by telephone nearly every day, and before lockdown was visited by her and his children, various friends, his father and other relatives." Professor Koppelman considered there to be an abundance of known risk factors indicating a very high risk of suicide. He stated, "I am as confident as a psychiatrist can ever be that if extradition to the United States were to become imminent, Julian Assange will find a way of killing himself." The professor's reports were fundamental to the extradition order's rejection, a surprising outcome given Judge Breitzer previously approved extradition in 96% of cases upon which she has ruled. Nonetheless, She accepts every other argument and charge put forward by the Department of Justice, in effect criminalizing a great many entirely legitimate journalistic activities, and setting the chilling precedent that citizens of any country can be extradited to the United States for alleged breaches of its national laws, therefore implying Washington's legal jurisdiction is global in scale. In response to the ruling, Australia's Shadow Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus, issued a forceful statement, declaring the opposition of Australia's Labour Party believed this has dragged on for long enough, particularly given Julian Assange's ill health, and demanding the Morrison administration do what it can to draw a line under this matter and encourage the US government to bring this matter to a close.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. The illegal recycling of electronics is a toxic business on a global scale. Every year, 3/4 of electronic waste from Europe and the U.S. disappears from official recycling system and is shipped illegally to India, China, or Africa. In the first part of the documentary, we took you on an investigative journey through Africa, China, Europe, and the U.S. in an effort to unravel the out-of-control corrupt systems enabling illegal e-waste recycling. Stay with us as we further investigate to reveal the apparatus of large-scale trafficking as well as a complex chain of responsibility and collusion in the next part of the program.
The U.S. is the only country in the world, apart from Haiti, that has not ratified the Basel Convention, the international agreement banning the export of toxic waste. To make matters worse, the U.S. government itself is as bad as anyone else when it comes to recycling its own discarded equipment.
The U.S. government is the single biggest producer of electronic waste on the planet.
Discarded electronics of whole departments are routinely put out to public auction instead of being sent to trustworthy recyclers.
Whoever gives the government the best rate, in other words, they can take it for free or almost for free, the government is kind of obliged to do that because in our laws you're supposed to go the cheapest way to save the taxpayer money. But the cheapest way is the dirtiest way.
Recyclers who do actually recycle find themselves the target of shady exporters. Plant manager Craig Lorch has been in the business for more than 20 years.
We get regular requests from brokers that are in other countries looking to buy materials, buying computers, metals, laptops, anything with valuable materials in them. We don't sell to them. We don't know what they're going to do with the materials. We don't know where it's going to go.
Craig is part of a minority of conscientious recyclers who collaborate with Jim Puckett and the Basel Action Network. But many U.S. recyclers do export. The Basel Action Network estimates that between 20 and 50 e-waste containers leave U.S. harbors every day. To find out where exactly U.S. e-waste is exported to, Jim came up with a very effective spying technique.
We will just go around to these people calling themselves recyclers, and you drive by them, and the beauty is that you can't hide a big old 40-foot container. so it's very easy to photograph them, and they have prominent numbers, and we take pictures of those and we date them.
Jim then goes online to find out where the e-waste containers are headed.
I can type that number into a database called TrackTrace. And here we see the whole record of that particular container in its last week's voyages. It's gone from Thailand to Singapore, now it's in New Zealand.
Analyzing the main trading routes for U.S. e-waste, Jim made a surprising discovery.
It comes through Hong Kong almost 65% of the time from the U.S. We didn't know that till we started tracking. Wow, they're all going to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong Harbor is the third largest port in the world, and any e-waste sent by the U.S. to Asia enters through here. But why isn't it seized and returned straight to sender? ...63,000 containers arrive here every single day on merchant ships of all shapes and sizes. Vincent Wong oversees the customs team at the harbor. The biggest terminal, Kwai Sing, receives nearly 50,000 containers a day. Up to 100 of them are estimated to contain e-waste. Tracking them down is a challenge.
Hong Kong is a free port. That means that the ship and the cargo don't have to declare to customs at the point of entry right away, except they are demanded by customs officers. They only need to declare after 14 days, within 14 days of the import or export of a consignment.
This means that by the time Wong and his colleagues receive the customs declaration, the cargo has usually long moved on. To combat this loophole, the customs inspectors pull out any containers which ring an alarm bell. For instance, because of the company's history or a tip-off from abroad, and submit them to an X-ray scan.
We can scan a container truck in less than 2 minutes, the whole truck, and then if necessary, we'll open the container for further inspection.
E-waste has its very own shape and look under an X-ray scanner. Items like computer monitors stand out clearly.
For e-waste, we have quite a number of cases in the past few years, and most of them are declared as plastic scrap or metal scrap.
Up to 36,000 e-waste containers are estimated to enter through Hong Kong Harbor every year, enough to fill 20 of the largest cargo ships. About 40 containers a year are intercepted, sent back, and their owners prosecuted.
We do not process each and every container coming or going out of Hong Kong. Around the world, there's no one custom administration that can process 100% of them.
As a result, there are always containers that escape the authorities. Chinese activists are trying to find out what happens to them.
I always want to do something to make some change. So I joined Greenpeace since 2002. The first campaign is working on the e-waste.
Lai Yun is investigating how the e-waste containers slipping through the controls at Hong Kong get to mainland China. Just north of Hong Kong Island in the New Territories, there is a perfect hiding place for e-waste in transit. Lai Yun has come to pick up the trail.
I heard about a lot of e-waste from the overseas, like the United States, coming to Hong Kong.
He soon finds a storage yard. The e-waste shipments await transport over the border, and since the storage of e-waste is not illegal, the authorities are turning a blind eye. There are dozens of yards in this area. The site contains everything from TV sets to monitors and computers. If these, as usually claimed on customs declarations, were really exported as usable second-hand goods, they wouldn't be sitting out in the open air in the rain.
I think that China and the United States, so important, work together to solve the e-waste problem. This is an international issue.
From the storage yards, the e-waste is smuggled across the border into mainland China. It's just a few miles away, but it's illegal.
The trucks reload in new territories and drive across very close, and they have to pay a bribe. It's the only way they could get across. Or you use a small coaster boat and go up the Pearl River Delta into areas like Nanhai. And there, again, you'd pay a bribe to unload it.
Once the e-waste has crossed the border, it travels to places like the town of Guiyu.
When we went to the Guiyu, we don't see any signs to say, okay, this is Guiyu. But we just smell, very strong, the smell. Okay, we know we arrived at Guiyu.
Guiyu is one of many Chinese towns and villages where illegal e-waste recycling is happening on an industrial scale. No. 80% of the population are involved, processing millions of tons of e-waste a year with the connivance of the industrialized nations. The owners of the yards buy the waste abroad for peanuts, then recycle it using cheap labor. No money is spent treating the toxic leftovers or protecting the workers, so an item can be recycled for a tenth of the cost charged in Europe or the US. As opposed to the African dump sites, in Guiyu, there is a division of labor.
Very typical local family workshop. The workers also recycle the plastic or CRT. This guy used the light to burn the plastic and classify different types.
Separating different kinds of plastic by burning and smelling them is a cheap and effective technique, but it damages the lungs. Another family workshop specializes in recovering minute amounts of gold by dipping motherboards into acid baths. The workers are risking cancer by breathing in the toxic smoke. Afterwards, the remaining acid is simply dumped in the river. The groundwater has also been polluted, and even a simple cup of tea is laced with toxins. The constant exposure to substances such as PCBs, lead, and mercury is causing numerous health problems, including nerve and brain damage, skin diseases, and a rise in birth defects.
Really, what's happening is people are externalizing costs. You don't want to solve the problem, you'd rather let someone else deal with it, and you'll never have to pay for it. You don't ever get a bill from China saying, you contaminated my land, you have to pay.
China's factories in the neighboring provinces, for instance in Shanghai, Yangzhou, and Guangdong, immediately buy up any recycled materials, such as copper, aluminium, iron, gold, and plastics. But e-waste recycling is not only about selling scrap materials. An even more lucrative business is the recycling of computer chips. In clandestine workshops, transistors, integrated circuits, and other components are taken off discarded motherboards. The harvested parts are sorted and cleaned and sold as brand new components for the production of new electronics. This trade is said to be worth 100 billion euros a year, but it carries a huge risk that has an impact all over the globe, wherever computer chips are a part of our lives. For instance, in trains, planes, cars, nuclear power plants, hospitals, in short, everywhere. The companies who build the control systems for this kind of equipment are finding it increasingly difficult to distinguish between new chips and refurbished ones, and to be sure that their products on which many lives depend are safe. For TQ Systems in Germany, this is a daily challenge. Since the original label has been painted over, it's hard to know which type of chip it really is. Clues pointing to the origin of a chip on the scrap heap are broken and missing pins, or labeling that has been scratched off with a crude and blunt instrument. If the chips were sold as new, they should have come from a factory like this